Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting and important stories from around the world. To make it easier for you to learn American English, we always present these stories at a slower speed. We also use fewer words that are easier to understand. Save the program as a podcast and then go back and listen again and again. Today we have two stories for you. First, we are off to the Middle East. The subject is the Netanyahu government in Israel and the formation of a Palestinian state. Then, we will talk about the complicated situation in Ukraine. Many people there are calling for a Russian connection, while others are seeking independence. If you are interested in world affairs and learning to speak American English, you have come to the right place. Let's get started with part one. Israel is increasing its efforts against an international boycott movement. Some activists are calling for the boycott of Israeli-owned businesses that operate in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. Observers say support for the boycott appears to have increased after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would never permit the creation of a Palestinian state. Since then, the Israeli leader has made comments that appear to conflict with his earlier statements. Anne Ball has more.
The BDS movement aims to put financial pressure on Israel to end the occupation and settlement of land it captured in the 1967 Six-Day War. Middle East expert Sharif Nashashibi says the campaign is growing stronger.
The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement has been increasingly effective. The Palestinian Authority is taking Israel to the International Criminal Court. As welcome as worldwide recognition is, there has to be accompanying pressure on Israel to make that state a reality.
The French-owned telephone company Orange said last week it would withdraw from a deal with Israeli operator Partner. The head of Orange later said his comments were based on finances, not politics. Prime Minister Netanyahu reacted angrily to the announcement. He invited the company's leader to come to Israel to explain the decision. Mr. Netanyahu said the government will stand against any attempt to harm Israel with lies, false accusations, and boycotts. We will push back any pressure, he said. We will report the lies and attack the attackers. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius says France does not support a boycott. Mr. Fabius said the head of Orange can decide what his company does, but he said a boycott is not recognized under international law. Most of Israel's allies have criticized the boycott movement, but they are becoming tired of waiting for Mr. Netanyahu to act. That is the opinion of Yossi Meckelberg, professor of international relations at Regent's University, London.
I think gradually it dawns on Israeli that there is out there, within international organization, in government, the European Union, even in the United States, those are the things that the Netanyahu government is blocking peace through expanding settlements. And hence they think about what can be done in order to enhance the chance of a peace agreement and think targeting economically the settlements.
U.S. President Barack Obama has said the international community does not believe that Israel is serious about a two-state solution.
Then it becomes more difficult to argue with those who are concerned about settlement construction, those who are concerned about the current situation. It's more difficult for me to say to them, be patient, wait, because we have a process here.
Israel blames Palestinian militants for blocking any peace process. On Sunday, Israeli aircraft struck the Gaza Strip after a rocket attack was launched into southern Israel. I'm Ann Ball.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The year-long conflict in Ukraine has energized those who support a united, independent country. But it has also created divisions between them and neighbors, friends, and family members who feel a connection to Russia. The political tensions have harmed personal relationships and have even led some married people to separate. Katie Weaver tells us more.
Lyudmila and Denise Sokno married 17 years ago. At the time, like most people who marry, they expected to spend the rest of their lives together. But conflict began between the two when Russian-supported rebels used a lack of leadership in Ukraine's central government to seize control of their town. Lyudmila is an ethnic Ukrainian. She says the seizure of the town hurt her emotionally. But her husband, who is half Russian, did not feel the same way. She says he thought the seizure would turn Ukraine into a new country with new possibilities. But she believed it was an illegal occupation and harmful to her rights. To try to ease tensions, Lyudmila and her husband agreed they would not talk about politics at home. She read news about Ukraine on the internet. Denis Sokno received his information from Russian state television. Denis Sokno said he and his wife began to have arguments about the war in Ukraine every day. So they separated. They then asked officials for permission to end their marriage. Yulia Parshina is head of the Kramatorsk Marriage Registration Office. She notes that during the last year of fighting in Ukraine, many people became frightened and canceled plans to marry. Others split up because of political differences when some of the men joined the rebellion against Ukraine's central government. Ms. Parshina says many families were broken because some members supported a united Ukraine and others supported the rebel-controlled Donetsk People's Republic. Lyudmila Sokno says her husband's beliefs about the rebels changed after he saw armed men supporting anti-Ukrainian beliefs and clashing with Ukrainian forces. She says he understood what was happening. In her words, he saw the rebels were not building something new, but just destroying. She admits her own opinion of Ukraine's central government has changed. She is no longer as excited as she once was. Denise says he understood in the wrong way. He says, "I have regrets, not only about our relations, but my main regret is that I was fooled." Lyudmila and Denise Sokno have agreed to finalize their divorce in the middle of June. But still, they are friendly with one another, and Denise hopes they can remain married. They both see a better future, even as the conflict between Ukraine and Russia continues. This is a war of politics, they agree, not a war of Ukrainians against Russians. I'm Katie Weaver.
You are listening to As It Is, a Learning English program from VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The Los Angeles City Council has approved a measure to increase the minimum wage, the lowest hourly pay rate permitted by law. Council members voted Wednesday to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Under the plan, the hourly pay rate will increase over the next 5 years until the new rate is reached. Workers for small businesses and nonprofit organizations will receive the $15 rate in 2021. Los Angeles, California is the second largest city in the United States. For workers who are paid the minimum wage, the council's move is welcome. However, many business groups, such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, say raising the minimum wage can create problems for small businesses. Aparna Murtha is an economist with the American Enterprise Institute. He says studies show that wage increases hurt job growth. Around the world, workers and employers argue over the issue of a minimum wage. Workers say they want to receive a minimum living wage. For many of them, that means one to meet their most important needs, including food, clothing, and shelter. Employers worry that high labor costs will affect the profitability of their business and its value to shareholders. And governments worry that they will lose trade, investment, and tax revenues if labor costs within their borders go too high. Requiring a high minimum wage for hourly work can have unwanted effects on youth unemployment. Businesses decide they need fewer unskilled workers or cut labor costs by using automation systems or even robots. Sean Height is a business expert with the University of Southern California. He says companies like McDonald's could answer falling profits by using machines to serve food. That would do little to help employment. A legal minimum wage, then, does not guarantee job creation. But it does provide an increase in the standard of living for the working poor, so long as inflation is not a problem. U.S. President Barack Obama has called on Congress to raise the national minimum wage. The president wants to increase the national minimum wage from the current hourly rate of $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. Last year, he signed an order to raise the federal minimum wage. As a result, the federal government now pays $10.10 to the individuals working on new service contracts. Some U.S. lawmakers are seeking to raise the minimum wage nationwide. It is likely that a floor for wages will be an issue next year as political campaigns heat up. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
This is Rich Kleinfeld.
And this is Phil Murray with The Making of a Nation, a VOA special English program about the history of the United States. Our program today is about the beginning of the administration of President John Kennedy.
January 20th, 1961. John Kennedy was to be sworn in that day as President of the United States. It had snowed heavily the night before. Few cars were in the streets of Washington. Yet somehow, people got to the ceremony at the Capitol building.
The outgoing president, Dwight Eisenhower, was 70 years old. John Kennedy was just 43. He was the first American president born in the 20th century. Both Eisenhower and Kennedy served in the military in World War II. Eisenhower served at the top. He was commander of Allied forces in Europe. Kennedy was one of many young Navy officers in the Pacific battle area. Eisenhower was a hero of the war and was an extremely popular man. Kennedy was extremely popular, too, especially among young people. He was a fresh face in American politics. To millions of Americans, he represented a chance for a new beginning.
Not everyone liked John Kennedy, however. Many people thought he was too young to be president. Many opposed him because he belonged to the Roman Catholic Church. A majority of Christians in America were Protestant. There had never been a Roman Catholic president of the United States. John Kennedy would be the first.
Dwight Eisenhower served two terms during the 1950s. That was the limit for American presidents. His vice president, Richard Nixon, ran against Kennedy in the election of 1960. Many Americans supported Nixon. They believed he was a stronger opponent of communism than Kennedy. Some also feared that Kennedy might give more consideration to the needs of black Americans than to white Americans. The election of 1960 was one of the closest in American history. Kennedy defeated Nixon by fewer than 120,000 popular votes. Now he would be sworn in as the nation's 35th president.
One of the speakers at the ceremony was Robert Frost. He was perhaps America's most popular poet at the time. Robert Frost planned to read from a long work he wrote especially for the ceremony. But he was unable to read much of it. The bright winter sun shone blindingly on the snow. The cold winter wind blew the paper in his old hands.
John Kennedy stood to help him. Still, the poet could not continue. Those in the crowd felt concerned for the 86-year-old man. Suddenly, he stopped trying to say his special poem. Instead, he began to say the words of another one, one he knew from memory. It was called The Gift Outright. Here is part of that poem by Robert Frost, read by Stan Busby.
The land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. Something we were withholding made us weak, until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright.
Soon it was time for the new president to speak. People watching on television could see his icy breath as he stood. He was not wearing a warm coat. His head was uncovered. Kennedy's speech would one day be judged to be among the best in American history. The time of his inauguration was a time of tension and fear about nuclear weapons. The United States had nuclear weapons. Its main political enemy, the Soviet Union, had them too. If hostilities broke out, would such terrible weapons be used?
Kennedy spoke about the issue. He warned of the danger of what he called the deadly atom. He said the United States and communist nations should make serious proposals for the inspection and control of nuclear weapons. He urged both sides to explore the good in science instead of its terrors.
Together, let us explore the stars, conquer the deserts, eradicate disease, tap the ocean depths, and encourage the arts and commerce. Let both sides join in creating a new endeavor, not a new balance of power, but a new world of law, where the strong are just, and the weak secure, and the peace preserved.
Kennedy also spoke about a torch, a light of leadership, being passed from older Americans to younger Americans. He urged the young to take the torch and accept responsibility for the future. He also urged other countries to work with the United States to create a better world.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
John Kennedy's first 100 days as president were busy ones. He was in office less than 2 weeks when the Soviet Union freed 2 American airmen. The Soviets had shot down their spy plane over the Bering Sea. About 60 million people watched as Kennedy announced the airmen's release. It was the first presidential news conference broadcast live on television in the United States. Kennedy welcomed the release as a step toward better relations with the Soviet Union. The next month, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev made another move toward better relations. He sent Kennedy a message. The message said that disarmament would be a great joy for all people on Earth.
A few weeks later, President Kennedy announced the creation of the Peace Corps. He had talked about this program during the election campaign. The Peace Corps would send thousands of Americans to developing countries to provide technical help. Another program, the Alliance for Progress, was announced soon after the Peace Corps was created. The purpose of the Alliance for Progress was to provide economic aid to Latin American nations for 10 years.
The space program was another thing Kennedy had talked about during the election campaign. He believed the United States should continue to explore outer space. The Soviet Union had gotten there first. It launched the world's first satellite in 1957. Then, in April 1961, the Soviet Union sent the first manned spacecraft into orbit around the Earth.
The worst failure of Kennedy's administration came that same month. On April 17th, more than 1,000 Cuban exiles landed on a beach in western Cuba. They had received training and equipment from the United States Central Intelligence Agency. They were to lead a revolution to overthrow the communist government of Cuba. The place where they landed was called Bahía de Cochinos, the Bay of Pigs. The plan failed. Most of the exiles were killed or captured by the Cuban army.
It had not been President Kennedy's idea to start a revolution against Cuban leader Fidel Castro. Officials in the last administration had planned it. However, most of Kennedy's advisors supported the idea, and he approved it. In public, the president said he was responsible for the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion. In private, he said, "All my life I have known better than to depend on the experts. How could I have been so stupid?"
John Kennedy's popularity was badly damaged by what happened in Cuba. His next months in office would be a struggle to regain the support of the people. That will be our story next week.
This program, The Making of a Nation, was written by Jerry Watson and produced by Paul Thompson. This is Phil Murray.
And this is Rich Kleinfeld. Join us again next week for another VOA Special English program about the history of the United States.